Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we are recording the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 16, 2019, is Bernard Kaminski. Thank you for joining us, Bernie.
Oh, hi. Glad to be here.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Okay. I was hired by SCI Camp Hill in March of 1989 as a drug and alcohol treatment specialist too. I was assigned to work in the New Values Therapeutic Community. A few years later, I was promoted to drug and alcohol supervisor, and approximately 10 years ago, I was promoted to drug and alcohol treatment manager at Camp Hill.
Okay, great. Now on to the Camp Hill riot.
Okay.
It is Wednesday, October 25th, 1989, at around 2:30 p.m.
Okay.
Where are you and what's happening?
At that time, we were doing groups with the therapeutic community participants. The way it was set up is there was a recovery unit trailer, there's a New Values trailer, and then there was an office trailer where our offices were and the group rooms were in that trailer. And we were doing groups in that room. At some point, usually we'd run groups to about 3 o'clock, like 1:30 to 3-ish. Some point shortly before the group was over, my supervisor came to me and said that, you know, we're not going to release the inmates to go back to the housing unit, just keep them in place. So I went back into the group room and I told the guys in the program, I said, listen, we're not going to send you back to the housing unit right now. Just sit here, relax, take it easy. I was out in the hallway observing them because my office was right across the hallway. And then what would happen was staff in our other unit could actually see what was going on. So we knew there was a riot. We knew there was an occurrence over by E-Gate. And then they would just call on the phone and tell staff what was going on down to our trailer. And obviously you didn't want the inmates to know, so we stayed in the hallway. We had the inmates in there. I remember going back into the room and I found scrounged up some magazines. And I gave them to the guys. There was probably 15 to 20 inmates in that group room. And I gave them, said, here's some magazines. You can sit back, read them a while. There was no smoking in the trailer. However, that day I said, if you got cigarettes you want to smoke, you know, go ahead, because there's windows you could slide open. Just smoke by the windows, go ahead. They would ask some questions as to what was going on, and you were kind of intentionally evasive because you didn't want them. They say, oh, I'm not exactly sure, but just relax. We'll get you out of here soon. And you know, they were fine. Then we kept getting phone calls, and then one phone call came back and it said, well, they're rioting in Mod 1. And you could see Mod 1 from the one trailer. And then a few minutes later, call back, they're rioting in Mod 2. And now the riot's in Mod 3. And then you heard the riot's now in Mod 4. And at that point, there was a road separating Mod 4 from the drug and alcohol trailer. So we were kind of next in line. And I remember in my office, I could look out the window and I could see the perimeter, and I saw all these state police lined up around the perimeter of the institution, but they weren't coming in. I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, hey, it's come on in. I'm ready for you to come in now. And then eventually they did come in before it crossed over to the drug and alcohol unit. It was a group of some of our CERT team, some state troopers. There were some counselors in there. I remember a counselor named Tom James was there with Helmanson. They had a flat jack and a batons, and they came down to our unit. We got the inmates out of the unit. They escorted them. I'm not exactly sure where they took them. And then once we swept the unit, then we went out and we joined that group with the CERT team. And then we start moving up towards mods 1, 2, and 3. And when we got up to mods 1, 2, and 3, I remember most of the members in that group had equipment, a helmet, a baton, whatever, and they were sort of pushing forward, heading towards E-Gate. And we didn't, because we were just coming out of groups. And there was an inmate there that, an older inmate, was having chest pains or something to that effect, and he thought he was having a heart attack. He was in the modulars 1, 2, or 3. And they had us, because we didn't have equipment, take him on a stretcher down the medical. So we took him down. I'm not sure where they had stuff. I think it was close to the rear gate where they had some medical for inmates. They didn't go outside the prison with them, but they had medical attention there. And we took him down there for attention, and then that took a couple minutes. And then, you know, we asked, where would you like us to go now? Do you want us to go back with the group? And they probably didn't want us going individually back with the group. We didn't have equipment anyhow. So they said, we went out through the rear gate, And then they said, surround the perimeter. So then we were outside the perimeter, and where our superintendent's office, that building now, that's where I stood. And you just stood, you observe things, you watch for things. You really couldn't see much from that perspective because it was over in the back of the jail. But it was pretty much a perimeter group and a show force. Then after that, it seemed like we were there forever, standing there forever. And then it's probably 11:30 around there where they had us come inside the institution. And then we went up to Deputy Henry's office, which was above control. And I was there with my supervisor, Kirk Kressler, and he wanted us to go over to the blocks. They had all the inmates secure in the blocks. There were multiple inmates in cells, but they were supposedly locked in. And we had to check to see if they were injured, if they needed medication, and what their needs were. And
how did you feel while you were doing that?
I was young, I was inexperienced, I was probably stupid. I wasn't thrilled with it, but I figured they knew what they were doing, and it needed to be done. So I remember going over to the blocks, and it was probably after midnight when we got over there. And I think I was on E and F block. And we'd walk in, and you go to the cells. And at that time, the blocks were a mess. The tiers were trash with trash. A lot of some water on the floor. They must have flooded the cells or whatever. And I do remember walking down the tiers, and some of the inmates were sleeping. And I really didn't like the idea of waking them up because they didn't want to be woken up. And then you had to wake everyone up. Were you injured? Are you on medication? Do you need any medication? And then you had to take all that information. And so we went down the tier. There was virtually no lighting because I think they smashed all the light bulbs out of the lights. And there were like emergency lights on, so it was very dimly lit. So you're walking down. There was a lot of fluids. You'd see some fluids dripping from the upper tier when you're walking on the lower tier, and you told yourself it was water, but you weren't sure. Mm-hmm. You got to the end of that tier. It was a very eerie feeling because it was something like out of a movie. It was just very quiet, very eerie, you know, poorly lit. You're walking through water. And so then after we got the names of the inmates that needed things, then we went back to Deputy Henry's area. We gave them the names. I'm assuming they gave it to medical. And then probably about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, they said we could leave. And I remember asking my supervisor, so what time do you want us back? And I think he asked Deputy Henry, he said, come back at your normal reporting time, which is 8 in the morning. So I live about 50 minutes away. I live out in Lebanon County by Fort Indian Town Gap. So by the time you get home, get a shower, you get an hour or two, and you get up. But, you know, it had to be done, and everybody knew that, and nobody had an issue with it. So then we came back in the next morning, about, it was probably 8 o'clock when I started, so we came back in. Worked that whole day. A lot of it was walking around the institution. There's a lot of trash, a lot of carpentry equipment laying around, hammers, screwdrivers, circular saw blades, that kind of stuff. You did a little cleaning up. You went down and looked at your unit where the drug and alcohol guys were to make sure everything was okay there. And then my quit time was 4:30. We might have worked a little bit later. And I remember my supervisor, Mr. Kressler, said, well, we have to have some people stay back for feeding. He said, but I'm gonna stay back. Why don't you guys go home, get some sleep, and I'll stay back. So I went home, and I remember getting to the house. It was dark. And at that time, you always had the TV on, you know, for the news coverage all over. So you walk in the house, the TV is on. And I sat down, I was making a sandwich, and I hear this news broadcast about the Camp Hill riots and everything. I'm like, okay, yeah, I know. And then all of a sudden I looked up and I saw there was stuff that was on fire that wasn't on fire. And it didn't make sense to me. I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, they're just rebroadcasting all the news of the events from yesterday. And then I realized that after the news broadcast at 6 o'clock, I believe they started rioting again. So when I noticed that, well, then I knew my supervisor was there and everything. So you immediately jumped in your car and you go speeding back. And I do remember it was a nice drive because you could do like 85, 90, and you had your ID on you. So, and you knew there was no troopers out because they're all over Camp Hill. So I remember flying back, and I was probably doing 85, 90.
Tell me what you were seeing as you were driving back. What could you see?
When I would get off at the Cedar Cliff Mall exit and come in Cedar Cliff Drive, and then when you turn on Lisburn Road, there was a roadblock right around there with state troopers. And, you know, you showed them your ID, they permitted you to go through. And I remember as I was pulling up towards the prison, basically all I could see was like fire all over the place, a lot of smoke. You could smell it. I remember when I got there, you couldn't get to the parking lot to park because everything was packed with emergency vehicles and everything. And I do remember I parked in Superintendent Freeman's front yard. So then we went out, and once we did that, I went over to where our superintendent's office was and asked them what they wanted me to do. And they said, well, go down to the basement, get an arm, a firearm. But by the time I got there, they had issued all the firearms. There weren't any firearms left, so they gave me a riot baton. And then they said, all right, you're going to be in the perimeter for now. And they sent me up again for perimeter coverage outside the fence up by the old central office building. And so we were up there the whole night watching from that vantage point. There's a lot of inmate activity because you're directly in front of group 2 and 3 where most of the activity was. So you could see an awful lot of inmates coming out. There's a lot of yelling, screaming, setting little fires in the middle of the courtyard. They were always fairly covered up, so you couldn't tell who they were. They'd come at the fence screaming at you and yelling all sorts of stuff. But you couldn't tell because they had their hoods up, they had their face covered with a towel or whatever. I do remember sitting there thinking, well, maybe if I just looked and, you know, maybe I recognize a pair of sneakers, or just certain people have walked certain ways, that maybe you could get an idea of what inmate was yelling, but yeah, I really couldn't. I do remember partway through the night, then they come up and they started taking wood out of the wood shop. The carpenter shop was inside the institution, and they were propping these boards up against the fence. It was either to protect them or to block our vision, but they were going through, it was painstakingly effort to put all this wood up against the fence. And then they'd still be yelling at you and things like that. And, you know, we just sort of stood there and observed. And I do remember when they started to come in for the assault to take that area back, there were shots fired. And as we were standing up there, you could hear things like hitting the fence and the asphalt in front of you. So I do remember myself and Mr. Kressler ran behind the dumpster that was behind there until they stopped shooting, because you could hear things pinging around and, you know, you didn't want to get hit. And then they did the skirmish line and came up and started to bring the inmates out of the blocks.
And that was early Friday morning?
Yes. Thursday night was when we were outside. I was outside the institution, yeah, and watching that. And then early Friday morning, because it was, the sun was just coming up. There was a little bit of a misty type fog. It always seemed nicer in the daylight there. You know, you always felt better. And when they saw them coming up, you actually start to feel like you were starting to get control back of the jail. And then the inmates would start crawling out. There was an officer or counselor there named Hal Mallory, who I believe might have been on K block, but I'm not sure. But I remember Mr. Kressler saying, I think that looks like Hal Mallory, but they am dressed like in inmate clothing. So I didn't know Hal that well because I wasn't there that long. Mm-hmm. But then they secured everybody. Then they escorted him. I wasn't sure where they were taking him, because to me it would make sense that since those guys were really involved in the riot, you wouldn't want to put them in the, mix them in with the other inmates that weren't involved in the riot. So I don't know if they took them down to the same, you know, athletic field and kept them separate or not. I don't know. I just saw them escorting them out. Wow. So.
And then when did you go home after that?
We were there for a while. I really don't know what time. It was later in the morning, early afternoon.
That same day?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
And then after that, the focus of the institution was getting the inmates out to other facilities. Did you play a role in that at all?
The initial focus was just getting the cells cleared so we could get them out of the yard.
Okay.
And so the next day when we came in, almost everybody worked together. That's there's a sense of camaraderie where, you know, maintenance, counselors, drug and alcohol, everybody's doing the same thing. Activities director, there's a guy named Terry Blues was the activities director there. And him and I were sort of paired together for a while, and all we did was go into the cell blocks and literally just threw everything out of the cells. We weren't trying to save anything, package anything. If they were upstairs, we threw it over the rail onto the tier, get it all cleaned out so you get everything out of the cell, and then we'd have security come in after we did that. Security would come in and inspect the cells, make sure there's no weapons, because we had thousands of inmates out in the yard. Mm-hmm. And you had to get them in because it was nice weather then, but it was the end of October. And so I remember there'd be stacks, a couple feet high of TVs, blankets, personal property, all that stuff. There were situations where I think the inmates might have knew that was going to happen when somebody said they found a stinger in a bucket of water where if he would have grabbed it, but I never encountered any of that, but I remember someone telling me that.
And of course, some of the cells, even after they were cleaned out, they weren't able to be occupied because they just weren't secure, holes in the walls and those kinds of things.
Right, or there'd be, plumbing, you could pull the drain thing out and there'd be a weapon or whatever. So our goal was just to get everything cleared out of it so they could come in and do the cell searches. So eventually we could get the inmates back in the cells.
Wow. So tell me, the second night, the modulars burned.
Yes.
Except for the new values one.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
Well, that was probably part of all the fire and smoke I saw when I was coming in. When we went in the next day, we went back in with the cell clean. You saw how much damage it was. I mean, you couldn't fathom the amount of damage. The New Values community, the inmates in there, to my understanding, actually fought some of the rioters off. There was an officer that was assigned to that unit. In that unit, it was a dormitory type setting, and the officer's desk would just be at the front of the dorm, so you were sitting there with them all the time. I believe it was Officer Freeman, and I think they put him in inmates' clothes and they got him out. So basically, they kind of saved him. And they fought off the rioters. I heard that they had all these buckets of water by the windows, and they had their towels and stuff, and they put wet water up against the windows so they couldn't throw stuff in, because what I was told by the inmates was that the inmates who were rioting was telling them, you better come out and join us or we're going to burn your trailer down with you in it. And so they were fighting them off, and they had buckets of water and things like that and putting it up against the windows. So to me, it seemed like they did what they were supposed to do.
Yeah. Looking back, that first day when you were handing out the magazines to them, they knew what was happening. I mean, did they know what was coming, and did they ever warn anybody?
The thing with the TCU is, or the TC, it's an isolated area. So those guys, the only interaction they had with inmates would be at Mainline and Yard. But the rest of the day, they were always in TC activities.
Okay.
Where the group rooms were, they really didn't have a clear view of the fence. They might have kind of an obstructive view. So from my office, which was on the other side, I could see clearly all the state troopers out there. I don't know whether or not they really saw them. They just seemed very calm. They just seemed like, okay, we'll sit here. That's what they said, we'll sit here. And, hey, they're letting me smoke. They never left me smoking here before. That's okay. So
with them going to Mainline, they didn't have any information?
To be honest, I don't know. Okay. I mean, we did have some FOI inmates in the TC.
Okay.
Nobody expressed it to anybody that I know of. But they seemed fairly calm. I do know when I came in the next day, when the modular units were burnt down, Mod 8 was the only modular unit, which was a TC that wasn't burnt. But I noticed my office building was burnt down, and I remember seeing a picture in the Patriot News I cut it out back then. It was a picture of the burnt building. It was my desk, and there was a pre-pearl melted right on it, because the guy was asking me after, where's my pre-pearl? So it was on my desk when this all happened. And then I saw this picture, and it literally the paper was melted on the desk, and the whole building was gone. So I do remember that. And that made it kind of hit home a little bit.
Yeah. Tell me about what you know about the rebuilding and Superintendent Beard then coming in to help rebuild.
What happened, the rebuilding, in my mind, they did it well. It's much better now. It's compartmentalized. When I started, we worked two evenings. So we'd work three daylight shifts, two evening shifts. And I remember in the evening shift, inmates were allowed to wear street clothing, So you really couldn't even tell if they were a volunteer or an inmate sometimes. And it was like a college campus. I mean, it was just wide open. The grass was nice and green. I can remember walking across there and thinking, this is just like college campus. It's beautiful. The buildings were nice looking buildings. So it was very wide open. Then after we stepped down, we cleaned the cells. They start putting the inmates back in. Next thing we did is we were working 12-hour shifts. And I remember I made an awful lot of TV dinners because that's what we were feeding them. And there'd be four, six inmates in a cell. You had to be very careful because if you gave one roast beef TV dinner in a cell and five chicken when they've been getting chicken all the time, it would stir things up there because they'd argue or fight over who gets the roast beef. Mm-hmm. So if you were aware of that, we get a bunch of chicken, we'd serve them first and then the roast beef later or whatever. But it seemed like that's all we did was make TV dinners for a long time. For a while there, we were on the phones calling, manning inmates' families could call in and ask about the inmate. We did that for a little bit. Then when they started stepping down, it was a long, gradual process. And the drug and alcohol program was probably the first part of the step down. We were all assigned, they moved all our inmates to E block, and they're all, the gates were all chained, there'd be four or five guys in a cell, but all the TC guys were together. And when they started the step down process, they were the first ones that they started to gradually let out. And I remember at the beginning, the only place we could do groups was over in the chapel. And so they would handcuff, and we were only allowed to move five inmates at a time. Mm-hmm. They'd handcuff them, and they'd have two COs with nightsticks escorting us and five inmates over to the chapel. They stayed cuffed in the groups, and the COs would stay there, and then they'd escort them back. And that was the start of the gradual step down. There was probably a lot of anxiety about it. I'm not sure everybody wanted to see inmates out again, but it started out kind of very very structured, and then it would go up to 10, and then eventually we could escort them by ourselves without the COs, and then eventually they didn't have to wear handcuffs, and so it gradually kept stepping down.
Same thing with the state police presence, stepping down?
Yes, you'd see state troopers on the block all the time. And they were pretty much sit up towards the front of the block, and they'd be sitting there with their shotguns. And,
really?
They had guns initially in there, but afterwards they didn't. There's always an issue of keys. There's a lot of keys missing, so there was concerns about that.
And then when the state police were finally leaving, I bet that was a little nerve-wracking for the employees.
For what?
For the employees when the state police were finally leaving, there was nobody at the institution anymore.
They were, and they were there for a long time, though, because I remember a lot of them retired shortly after that. So they were there for a fair share of time, and we were starting to step things down.
Did you have a debriefing at all?
We did have a debriefing.
And what was that like?
Didn't go well. Yeah. There's a psychologist named Dr. Josephson who ran our debriefing, and he started off just by asking, how do you feel? Well, that just everything went out there. And there was an awful lot of frustration with administration that they either didn't do enough or they knew what was going on, and staff felt betrayed. Some staff felt like they're putting in situations where their life was in jeopardy. So there's an awful lot of frustration, some anger. It didn't last very long after that, so they just stopped it after that. So I'm not too sure the debriefings were that effective.
Right. And did you have any stress show itself to you through nightmares or anything like that? How did it impact you?
I really probably didn't understand PTSD, but now I think I have a little bit better understanding. The things that got me were the sound of helicopters, the smell of things burning, and actually I got tired of pizza because it was very nice of Domino's to provide pizza for several weeks, but if you're working 12-hour shifts and you start eating pizza two, three times a day, there is too much of a good thing. And so I just got tired of pizza. So when I see pizza, I think of the riot. But Probably the smell of things burning every so often make you think of the riot. I live close enough to the gap that when they would do their drills of the helicopters, and I know, like, if they did them early in the morning on a weekend and I'd be sleeping and I'd hear that helicopter flying low over my house, I know I'd jump up startled. And it was probably the sound of helicopters was probably the longest one, because mm-hmm. They were flying around the whole duration of the riot.
Right.
And one of my supervisor, Mr. Kressler, was one of the people. He stayed back to feed. And I remember talking to him the next day when I came in, and he was telling me that, you know, they open up the block doors to take food in, and he said, you saw inmates running around the block. And he said, then they took off running, and I guess the truck was starting to move, and he said, I was running, trying to catch up to the truck. And he said, I just jumped on the back of it, and then he went over, and he was trapped in control with a group of people in there,
okay.
And they used all their belts to get weapons up and down. And then the state police came in when Sergeant Beck allowed them to come in. They came in and they pretty much saved him. So I remember him telling me that story. And I thanked him for not making me work that night. So, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else that you wanted to share?
The only other thing I can think of is after the riot, when they were bringing out charges against some of the inmates, I remember I got a subpoena. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me why they were subpoenaing me. And because when you come into the main gate, they say, hey, you got to go up here to see somebody. And they said, you have a subpoena to testify for inmate, I can't remember his name, it might have been Green or something like that. I didn't recognize the inmate name. I was like, what do they want me to do this for? But you have to honor a subpoena. So I went down to the courthouse, and this attorney came out. And he said, I'm representing this inmate, and he's been charged with the riot and assaulting C.O. Arnold, who was beaten very badly, and I want you to testify on behalf of the inmate. And I looked and said, I don't understand what you're talking about. And he said, well, one inmate that was in your TC program is turning state's evidence. And this particular inmate, my gut feeling is he probably might have been involved in the riot, and maybe he's turning state's evidence to reduce his charges. He was an FOI inmate, and he was very radical when he was in the TC. I remember him saying, you know, I was a blue-eyed devil because I had blue eyes, and if I gave him treatment, it was, you know, because he was an FOI and all this stuff. And he eventually was removed from the program because he wasn't complying at all. And he was very disruptive. So he got removed from the program. So he said, well, this inmate, Nolan Burlark, is testifying, saying that he saw my client assault Arnold. And he said, I want to put you on the stand. And he said, you were his counselor, weren't you? I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'm going to put you on the stand. Did you kick him out of the TC program? I said, yes, we did. And he said, well, I just want to put you on the stand because I want to attack his credibility. And I really had no desire to testify for an inmate, particularly against Arnold. I mean, because he really was brutalized. So I said, I don't think you really want to put me on the stand. And he goes, yes, I am. He said, Burlark, you know, you said you kicked him out. You know, I want to attack his credibility. I remember saying to him, I said, well, one, I'd probably be a hostile witness, but if you put me on the stand, the one thing I will tell you is, although Burlark was a terrible inmate, he was very disruptive, I said, part of the problem that he got removed because he never lied to me. He would just tell me right up front he hated my guts. I said, he never lied to me. And I said, so I really can't challenge his credibility because he was always very honest with me. And turns out that I sat out in the lobby the entire day, and he never called me, and that was the end of that. But they were trying to find ways to, you know, attorneys, I guess that's their job. But I do remember, I thought it was really unusual that I'd be subpoenaed for an inmate that I never heard of.
Wow.
So
amazing.
It was.
Any other interesting stories or memories?
I'm sure there's tons of them, but I can't remember any at the moment. Just the camaraderie. I thought that was important too. When I started there, Mr. Kressler, he was a phenomenal supervisor, and I'm the mentor coordinator at Camp Hill right now. And I always tell people, I said, we always had mentoring programs. It was just unofficial. And I said, he took me under his wing during that riot. I just followed him around because he knew the jail and I felt comfortable following him around. And so I do remember, you know, just hanging out with him, getting a lot of information from him. He sort of taught me everything I know. So I he went through a lot during the riot, mm-hmm. and I mean, we remained, you know, pretty good friends. So right. there was a story there, but I lost it.
That's okay. So, well, Bernie, I want to thank you for participating in this.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I'll be interested to read the article.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.